if we get the bad news, we got to give $15 million back, is that it'll be over time.
The Denali Commission tries to unravel a federal budget puzzle. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, August 3rd. Good evening. I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, trying to make sense of the tragic murder of a Juneau teenager in Arkansas.
It's just gone through our church. It's just breaking our hearts what happened to this family. It's just a senseless, senseless thing.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. And by
AT&T, rethink possible. Details at att.com/Alaska or 1-800-252-7266.
The state has approved a right-of-way lease agreement for the Alaska Standalone Pipeline, the in-state gas project, which has the approval of the Alaska State House. Department of Natural Resources Commissioner Dan Sullivan last week signed an agreement with the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation, which was tasked by the legislature with developing a plan for the in-state gas line. The agreement grants access to state land for potential development of the 737-mile natural gas pipeline from the North Slope to Big Lake. Dave Norton is manager of engineering and regulatory affairs for AGDC. He says the state lease is for 427 miles, more than half the length of the proposed gas line.
State lease is a big deal. This is the first non-conditional pipeline right-of-way lease granted by the state in a long, long time. The big deal about it is it not only moves the project forward, it will likely be perceived as a significant milestone by and increase the project interest and confidence among potential shippers and developers. They'll see this as just another example that this is a real project and it's got some real legs to it.
Norton says AGDC is in the middle of an environmental impact statement process now.
The version that the public sees and gets to comment on is scheduled to be out in September, and there'll be quite a few public meetings up and down the pipeline right-of-way. And the Corps of Engineers is the lead agency for the EIS, so they'll be conducting these meetings.
If approved, a final EIS will be out by the end of the year, he says. The Army Corps of Engineers must issue the Record of Decision and approve wetlands permits necessary for gas line construction. The state agreement does not cover the entire length of the line, however. Norton says additional agreements must still be signed with Alaska Native corporations and federal and private owners of lands the gas line would traverse if it is built. The proposed natural gas line would run from Prudhoe Bay along the Dalton Highway and Taps Route to Livengood, then head south across Minto Flats to the Parks Highway near Nenana, then follow the highway to connect to the Beluga gas line from the west side of Cook Inlet. Gas would then be provided for the local distribution system. Another spur line running from Nenana would provide gas to Fairbanks. AGDC President Dan Foskey has signed the lease agreement. Foskey calls the right-of-way deal a major milestone in the progress made on the project. As Congress debates how to cut federal spending, federal managers are left without answers about how their agency will be impacted. In May, APRN reported Congress said the Denali Commission may have to return $15 million from 2010 carryover appropriations. But 3 months later, the commission is still waiting for clarification about that amount. APRN's Lori Townsend reports.
The problem lies with two federal agencies who are interpreting congressional intent differently. The Office of Management and Budget says simply, Congress wants the money, send $15 million back. But Denali Commission Federal Co-Chair Joel Nehemiah says the Government Accountability Office sees it differently.
They haven't determined whether we need to give back $15 million because they're very closely looking at the question that Congress put forward of unobligated prior year funds. In their mind, that means that that's FY10 and prior. And that if we were to give FY11 funds, then we have essentially gone against Congress.
The cloudiness doesn't end there. GAO says the amount could be only $1.4 million. That's the commission money left unobligated at the time of the signing of the 2010 budget. Niemeyer says he has asked for written clarification from both bodies, something the nearly 30-year federal employee says is perhaps unprecedented. He knows of no other agency that has questioned the mandates of the OMB. Niemeyer says the commission typically gets between $5 to $6 million returned each year as projects come in under budget. Paying $1.4 million would be feasible without much fallout, but if the final amount is $15 million all at once, that will be disruptive.
If we get the bad news, we've got to give $15 million back. Is that it'll be over time, not between now and the end of the fiscal year. Because the only way it's going to happen, if it's between now and the end of the fiscal year, we'd have to cancel active projects.
Those projects, Niemeyer says, would mainly be power system upgrades and waterfront projects. These are funded through Denali's base appropriation. The commission also helps direct money to projects from other agencies, and those funds are of concern to Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation President Gene Peltola. YKHC has its own construction arm, and they are currently finishing up their 25th and 26th Denali Commission-funded clinics in Nunumpachuk and Mountain Village. Peltola says, to date, YKHC has built over 100,000 square feet of clinic space with $35 million. He says there are 8 villages that need new clinics, and that won't happen without Denali Commission funds.
Basically, what we're hearing is, you know, that the commission hasn't received any designated funding from the feds for clinic construction. You know, Senator Murkowski tried to get $10 million in the 2011 budgetary process for new clinic construction in rural Alaska, and that didn't prevail.
Greg McIntyre is YKHC's Vice President of Support Services, which encompasses building construction. He says YKHC has returned about $1.8 million in funds to the Denali Commission after completing the last 6 clinics between $200,000 and $300,000 under estimate. He does not want to see that money returned to the federal government.
We haven't been frivolous by any means. You know, we've been very good at being thrifty, and so it'll be a disappointment if that doesn't go back into healthcare, whether it's ours or someone else's.
It's not yet clear if all or part of the clinic money will be protected. It will depend on what funding stream it originated from. YKHC President Peltola says the future is concerning for securing infrastructure funds for rural Alaska.
I feel that it's a coming of a new age. We've never experienced this uncertainty in the past. On a smaller scale, yes, but not like it is now.
Both YKHC officials say Denali Commission funds have been critical, not only for construction of clinics and other infrastructure in rural Alaska, but also for training and jobs, saying a decade ago, only one laborer may have been employed in a village building project. Now, local hire is nearing 100%. Health aid jobs, dental health therapists, and billing and coding work also stays local. The commission's Niemeyer says, in addition to changing how he allocates funds to better address congressional concerns, he's also revising the expenditure rate. Niemeyer says many entities build their project and then send a bill, which makes it appear that projects are stagnant. He wants quarterly billing.
And so then we can show to Congress that, you know, money isn't languishing, that these projects are moving forward as Congress wants, and you know, good things are happening. But if you look at the balance sheet and you see several projects where there's no money going out, you would just assume that those projects are inactive. Well, we're going to start addressing that question.
Niemeyer says written opinions clarifying whether 15 or 1.4 million must be sent back is expected from both GAO and OMB by August 15th. Commissioners have a meeting scheduled for the next day. In Anchorage, I'm Lori Townsend.
Governor Sean Parnell is working to change what he sees as the direction of federal management of wetlands in the state. In a letter to the Environmental Protection Agency and the Army Corps of Engineers, the governor objects to new guidelines for wetlands permitting and management, which he says expands their reach of their current jurisdiction. Deputy Chief of Staff Randy Ruaro says the guidelines will have the same impact as formal regulations, only they are being written in a much less formal manner. He says the government is writing tests that will be applied to determine their authority over public or private lands, and they are being written to expand the amount of land it calls wetlands.
And in that regard, it's expanding the scope of authority and the potential number of instances where the EPA and the Corps would be able to come in and tell a property owner, you can or you cannot do this with your property because it qualifies in their mind as wetlands.
Ruaro says the federal agencies are also defining wetlands within the guidance they are preparing. He sees those definitions as vague, based on U.S. court decisions that are not clarified by federal statute.
It's difficult to apply and understand. It's hard for a property owner to look at the test that they're setting out and know for sure whether or not they have to go start a long and expensive permitting process with the Corps and EPA or not.
Ruaro says he anticipates a decision on how the federal agencies will proceed by this fall. He says Alaska and seven other western states are watching the process and will decide then whether to take any action. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, cleaning up from the Kenai dipnet fishery.
Yeah, some people left their whole campsites, the tents, everything closed. Trash bags, we saw a complete wardrobe.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Rasmussen Foundation sabbatical program offers nonprofit executives and tribal leaders paid time away from their jobs for personal renewal and growth. As a result, organizations often become stronger. October 1st is the deadline to apply. Learn more at Rasmussen.org. This message sponsored by the Rasmussen Foundation.
Like Juneau, a small Arkansas town is trying to make sense of the death of a 19-year-old Juneau man who was allegedly beaten by four teenage boys while he was visiting their community. As previously reported, Kevin Thornton died from his injuries last Wednesday in a Little Rock hospital where he'd been in a coma for a week. The sheriff's investigator is calling the assault completely random violence. The youth charged in the attack will be tried as adults for murder. KTOO's Rosemary Alexander has been piecing the story together.
It's been hot in Malvern, Arkansas this summer, even reaching 100 degrees last month, though the evening of July 20th was slightly cooler. Pastor Dennis McClintock was running Wednesday Youth Night at the Glen Rose Missionary Baptist Church when a passerby brought in a young man he'd found struggling in a ditch about a half mile away.
The passerby thought he was having a heat stroke. It's very, very hot here, you know. He stopped and picked him up and brought him to our church, thinking we need to get him in a cool spot.
He told them he was Kevin Thornton from Juneau, but couldn't relate what happened to him. McClintock says they sat him in a chair
and got a cold towel and put it around his neck and got him a drink. And one of our ladies called 911 and the sheriff because he was clearly beaten up.
The ambulance soon came and took him to Baptist Medical Center in Little Rock, about 30 miles away. A couple of days later, McClintock heard that Thornton was in a coma and not expected to live. He and another parishioner went to the hospital where parents Bill and Darlene and sister Katie from Juneau had gathered along with family and friends from Massachusetts and Arkansas.
Just asked him if there was anything we could do, and Darlene said, well, if you could bake a cake real quick, it's our daughter's 23rd birthday. So I continued to talk to Bill and Darlene while this other church member slipped out, and he made a phone call and got a cake on the way.
Kevin Thornton died 2 days later of injuries he had suffered in an assault around the bend from the Traskwood Road Church. It's not just that a Good Samaritan took the injured man to the church. The boys accused of the assault had stopped there minutes before.
I was a little bit of a ruckus. They had seemed to be drinking, and so we had a church member asking them to leave.
McClintock says they peeled out of the parking lot, and a church member followed. He noticed two young men walking along the road, and then the boys in the truck turned around.
This church member just assumed that they knew each other and that they were just going back to talk to these boys. Well, he went on, didn't see anything, but apparently somewhere in there is when they beat him up.
Hot Spring County Sheriff's Investigator Philip Calhoun had enough evidence to arrest two of the youth on Tuesday. The next day, two others turned themselves in. They were arraigned Wednesday morning on charges of first-degree battery. When Thornton died later that day, the charges were increased to second-degree murder, a Class A felony. Now they face enhanced charges.
Just their numbers of three or more ups the classification of the felony by one place.
Calhoun says a 14-year-old boy, two ages 16, and a 17-year-old face a Class Y felony, which is Arkansas's most serious category of offense. Their names have not yet been released because they are juveniles. He says Kevin Thornton was simply along for a walk and became a victim. He and 20-year-old Jerry Haynes of Malvern were going to Haynes' ex-girlfriend's house.
She had his class ring. They were going to get the class ring. And a part of my questioning was whether or not the boys in the truck were now dating this girl. Nope. No. We cannot find any motive at all. And I've interviewed every single one of them. They all say the same thing. We just wanted to fight. Found these two guys walking, and so we got out and beat them.
The teens are being held in separate juvenile detention facilities outside Hot Spring County. Judge Philip Sheeran revoked their bond. No trial date has been set, and Calhoun thinks their lawyers would want it moved.
If I were their lawyers, I would say that it's such a high-profile case that I couldn't get 12 jurors that didn't know about the case already.
Malvern is Hot Spring County seat and has a population of about 10,000. Glen Rose is a dot within Malvern. It has a school, corner store, and the Missionary Baptist Church. Calhoun and Pastor McClintock say it's hard to believe such a crime could happen in their little town.
It's just gone through our church. It's just breaking our hearts what happened to this family. It's just a senseless, senseless thing.
This is the memory that they're going to have of our state, you know. We sent my son off to Arkansas one time, and while he was there, he got murdered by a bunch of redneck juveniles.
Here in Juneau, many people have heard about the tragedy and wonder what the story really is. Thunder Mountain High School music instructor Brian Van Kirk lives next door to the Thorntons and had Kevin in class. He was one of 50 members of TMHS first graduating class in 2010. Van Kirk has been hearing from a number of Thornton's classmates. He can relate to their angst. Years ago, Van Kirk's best friend from Juneau was killed in a drive-by shooting in Texas.
It's hard right now because there's a lot of anger. There's a lot of information that isn't known. A lot of it is speculation. But the big thing is just being able to talk and come to remember Kevin for who he was, which was, you know, a fun-loving guy who had an infectious smile and a wonderful attitude towards life.
Memorial services for Kevin Thornton will be held next week at St. Paul's Catholic Church. In Juneau, I'm Rose Marie Alexander.
Scientists at the Alaska Volcano Observatory are keeping an eye on Cleveland Volcano. The Aleutian Chain Volcano started showing increased thermal activity last month. Yesterday, AVO raised the alert level after identifying a new lava dome on the volcano. Dave Schneider is a geophysicist with AVO.
At this point, it's really taken the form of just sort of a passive lava flow or lava dome that's growing in the summit. It's about maybe 150 feet across or so at this point, estimated. But no ash has been detected so far.
AVO scientists are studying satellite images in case Cleveland starts spewing ash that could be hazardous to airplane traffic in the area. Schneider says the lava dome forming now on the volcano could be leading up to a bigger eruption.
This may increase the possibility of a more explosive event if it pressurizes the system, but without any instruments on the island itself to measure earthquake activity, really can't provide much of a forecast of what we think is to come.
Cleveland is one of about 20 historically active volcanoes in Alaska that don't have seismic monitors. Schneider says because its location is so remote, getting instruments there would be tricky.
It becomes an extremely costly operation. It would require a shipborne helicopter and everything to actually get out there and to install a network. And then also not only to install it, but to maintain it over time. And so the priority at this point has been on volcanoes that are nearer to population centers and infrastructure.
Several years ago, during another Cleveland eruption, one of the best views of the volcano was from space. AVO took a call from an astronaut who watched the eruption and was able to email pictures from orbit.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. And by the Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com.
Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 26 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8437.
The Kenai River personal use dipnet fishery has closed for the season. It ended at midnight Sunday, but for the city of Kenai, the cleanup takes a few more days. KDLL's Ben Stanton has the story.
The city park and recreation department rakes up the fish heads and pushes them down past the high tide line so they'll be washed away. Monday afternoon, Alex Cook is taking a quick break in between sweeps of the beach. He's driving a Parks and Rec tractor with a large metal implement attached to the back. It's basically a giant rake.
One dip netter said it should be called the Sanboni.
The result of the work is what looks like a groomed area where the fish carcasses have been raked up and moved. Cook says that fish waste is not all they've had to remove.
Yeah, some people left their whole campsites, the tents, everything, clothes, trash bags. We saw a complete wardrobe. People would just at the end just leave their stuff and leave. And then we have to all pick it up.
Really?
So if anybody wants a free tent, you better hurry up.
Cook himself did not dip net this year. He says it's a little tough to see that type of behavior and other behavior.
And some people that really irritated me, they'd fish and then leave whole fish out on the beach, dead, rotten, wouldn't even clean them or anything. Wasting fish.
But many people do respect the beach, and Cook says he likes this job. Cook fires up the tractor and heads back out. He says the goal with the raking is to return the beach to the way the local community expects it to be. In Kenai, I'm Ben Stanton.
An anthropologist has found what she believes are stone tools in a street excavation in downtown Sitka. The finds, if they are confirmed, could help shed light on Paleolithic humans who either lived in or passed through the region. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
First, let's make clear that this is not an epic story about archaeology. This is about a couple of rocks that you or I, or anyone who didn't know what to look for, would have walked right by, or maybe even have skipped into the ocean.
But it's a simple tool where you have a certain kind of rock, and you drop that rock on another rock, a flake comes off, and if it's nice and sharp along there, you'll use it for a while, you can rip it like that, use it as a skin scraper or for whatever you're scraping, then when it gets worn out, you throw it away.
Nancy Yaw Davis is an anthropologist by trade and an archaeologist by coincidence. She's standing next to a trench in Sitka's Monastery Street, about a block from her home. The rock, called a boulder chip, is absolutely unremarkable. Wilma Flintstone did not have anything like this in her kitchen. Until Davis folds her fingers around it and it becomes a compact and efficient looking scraper. Next, she shows me a stone point called a biface.
The shape, the size, it's about 3.5 inches by 2 inches. The materials, unusual material, the way it could fit on a spear, and it just stood out.
Davis honed her eye for stone tools working for years in the Cook Inlet area. She holds a master's degree from the University of Chicago and a doctorate from the University of Washington. She's the author of numerous publications, including a major book exploring connections between prehistoric cultures in Japan and the Americas, called The Zuni Enigma. Monastery Street is the epicenter of Sitka's cultural footprint. Prior to the construction of Crescent Harbor in the late 1960s, this area was known as Crescent Beach. It's also on the Indian River floodplain. The river is about a mile away now, but millennia ago, who knows? River meandering, glacial rebound, volcanic activity, and dramatic sea level changes have all affected the landform. Close to where Davis found the possible stone tools is what appears to be a deposit of beach cobble. It could be an ancient river beach, or it could be fill from previous sewer work. Because the site has been disturbed many times, it doesn't really matter. In archaeology, as in real estate, it's sometimes location, location, location.
Human nature really hasn't changed over the millennia.
Mark McCallum is the archaeologist for the Tongass National Forest.
And that the qualities that attract you or me to a location today are probably some of the same qualities that attracted people hundreds, if not thousands, of years ago.
McCallum knows Davis, but has not had a chance to examine the possible artifacts. But he considers it by no means far-fetched that a backhoe could unearth stone tools in downtown Sitka. This is no gold rush town or a former cannery site that has evolved into a modern city. As even the Huffington Post has recently declared, places in Alaska don't get much better for us or for early man. McCallum urges us to view Sitka through a paleo lens.
What would be the qualities that you would look for? Think about it. Those things that you would seek, say level ground to erect your tent, well drained, perhaps proximity to water, perhaps a nice view, those are all factors that a paleo person might have sought as they made their way down the outer coast.
Here comes Tommy in the bulldozer. And I'd like to check up here for more pieces of ceramics. I don't expect to find
it. It makes it all the more interesting that Davis almost literally fell into this job. The public works map of Monastery Street refers to it as an area of possible archaeological significance, and the city requires that utility work there be monitored by an archaeologist. The contractor, ACI, had not been able to find one by the time work started, and Davis says she recommended several, all of whom were unavailable. In the end, they offered her the job.
I thought of my background of archaeology in the Philippines when I was a student, excavating in a cave that where people had been buried in different sized ceramic jars for about 1,000 years.
Davis bagged and cataloged over 80 specimens in a few days of work, everything from colonial-era ceramic fragments, pieces of old pipe, door handles, to a piece of stone china chamber pot. The stone tools, however, if they prove up, will be the star discoveries for this accidental archaeologist. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. You can hear us online at alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Rosemary Alexander in Juneau, Ben Stanton in Kenai, Robert Woolsey in Juneau. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau and Lori Townsend from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com.
And by
Alaska Business Monthly Magazine, publishing statewide news for over 26 years from Alaska's business sector, government, and industries. Information and subscription online at akbizmag.com. We all need energy to power our homes and businesses. Tapping renewable energy sources like wind, geothermal, and hydro helps keep our economy local, creating jobs, revenue, and power for the state. Learn more at realaska.org. This message sponsored by Renewable Energy Alaska Project, committed to creating a sustainable economic future for Alaska. A PFD reminder, check the status of your 2011 PFD application with My PFD Info online at pfd.alaska.gov. You can view or change your voluntary deductions until Wednesday, August 31st. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.